Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about bullying, something that is not particularly new, but something that is getting more and, I think, well-deserved attention from researchers and also from teachers and school administrators and perhaps also parents. We're talking this morning with a guest who has done research on the subject. Her name is Dorothy Espelage. She is professor of educational psychology here at the University of Illinois, and we're pleased to have her here in the studio to talk with us. If you're interested, by the way, in doing some more reading in some depth on the subject, she is the editor of a book titled Bullying in American Schools, which is should be available. It might be a little bit difficult to find, published by Lawrence Erlbaum Associates. It's a, I imagine that's an academic publisher.
Yes, it is.
It? Yeah, okay, so you might not be able to find it in, you know,
Amazon.com.
Okay, very good. If you're interested in reading up on the subject, you can also look. You can look for the book. And of course, your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, we certainly welcome people's questions and comments. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you
for being here. Can you put some numbers on this? Do we know just how much bullying there is?
Yeah, just it's probably been in the last 10 years that we've just started to look at this in the United States. This is a phenomenon that's been studied internationally since the late 60s, so we're a little bit behind here. We like to think we're progressive, but unfortunately, this is one area that we're not on top of. We're starting to do more research, and essentially 15% of students in our middle schools, and now it's becoming even earlier in elementary school, are kind of seen as chronic bullies. So 15% of any school that we've surveyed across the country includes, those are the students that bully on a regular basis. About 17% of kids are chronically victimized. So you're talking about 32% of children, a nice third, that are involved in some ways. Unfortunately, the remaining 68% are those kids that are standing around egging on the bully, supporting the bully, not sticking up for the victim. So in one way, in the last 10 years, we're starting to think about it not just as kind of a bully on a victim dyadic interchange or interaction, but in fact, there's groups of kids that are creating this climate in which this is tolerated. Yeah. So it's amazing how common it is.
Well, that's really interesting, and I want to make sure that we talk about that because, as you say, we may have this tendency to focus on the aggressor and the victim and say, well, this is something that just involves two kids. But really, you've got to consider these three parties, the aggressor, the victim, and everybody else, and how the everybody else enters into it and either can be a force for making it happen or not, stopping it from happening.
And that everybody else is called a bystander. So we actually are starting to talk about and name those bystanders as being, and again, that comes out of the Canadian research. So if you've seen footage on Dateline or other types of programs where in Canada they're actually videotaping kids on the playground, and that's how we've become to understand that it's a group phenomenon, that there's kids that are encouraging each other to do this. Unfortunately, when we look at prevention programs in the school, there's not a single prevention program that looks at the peer group component, that there's pressure to go along with the children to do this. So, in some ways we're identifying this, but what we used to do is just pull out those bullies. In many schools in the state of Illinois, I talk to principals that are quite proud of pulling out the bully. Unfortunately, it's like weeding your garden. The weeds just start to grow back. And so in some ways, it's a kind of an odd analogy, but it's one in which as we pull out the bullies, if in fact that climate is just very fertile for a climate just to kind of harassing behavior, then a bully is just going to emerge continually through our schools.
Mm. One thing that you mentioned was that there seems to be some evidence that perhaps that the age of the bullies is starting to go down. That is, we're starting to see it in younger kids. So that may be one way in which this has changed. I think a lot of people would say, reflecting on their own childhood experiences, there were bullies in my day, and maybe that there always were. Is there any way in which you think that somehow the problem is getting worse, or is it really the same as it ever was?
Well, I don't think we have studies to show that it's gotten worse. One, I think we're paying attention to it. So once you start paying attention to things, then it feels like it's worse. But many of us can think about many of the callers that are or whatever. Anybody that's listening can think about their experiences. Unfortunately, the introduction of technology, the phenomena of bullying is changing in our schools tremendously. One, what we're learning is bullies are very, very socially skilled. In some ways, it goes against the research. We always thought they were just kind of like socially unskilled, and certainly they would be rejected from the peer group. But they're very socially skilled. They know when to do this. The introduction of technology and the use of computers by kids are completely changing the way in which rumors are spread, the way in which kids are taunting each other. And so in some ways, as researchers, we're a little bit behind, and as teachers and as parents, because we're not on top of how it is that kids are now harassing each other, we're starting to figure this out. So I think that in some ways the flavor has changed. It has certainly become a phenomenon that's emerging much younger. So I present to teachers all the time, and 10 years ago when I would present to teachers, you know, third and fourth grade teachers, this was not a problem. Now you present to teachers and they're like, we are seeing this harassing, you know, the exclusion. You can't come to my birthday party. You can't be in my play group as young as pre-K.
Yeah. Well, that gets another important question, I think, and that is what exactly is it that we are talking about? I'm sure that when you talk about bullying, probably the first thing people think of is physical violence. That is one child that's beating up on some other kid. And while that, I suppose that may be going on, it's much more complicated than that. We are talking about things like verbal abuse and emotional abuse, and that in fact might be more prevalent than the old-fashioned playground bully who you think is physically abusing other kids.
Oh, it's most certainly. I think the research is, and that's one reason we're focusing on this. You know, the United States were concerned about this because of the school shootings and the report that came out by the Secret Service and said that, in fact, many of the school shooters were victims of bullies. And most of the time it was not. There's some physical component. But for the most part, you're right that the most prevalent form is verbal types of aggression. It has to be chronic. It's not that somebody just called you a name and then they called you a name 6 months later, but it's every day. And in some cases, when we interview kids that are being chronically victimized in Illinois schools, they say, I really wish they would just hit me and be done with it. But the fact is that they come into the schools hoping that they would not be taunted, terrorized. At any corner they could be. Yes, there's certainly physical abuse, but it's mostly verbal. It includes rumor spreading. It includes being excluded from groups. And again, the physical part, one, because it's much more noticeable, is not as prevalent.
We have as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dorothy Espelosh. She is a professor of educational psychology at University of Illinois. And we're talking about bullying, something that she's done a lot of research on. And if you have questions, you certainly are welcome to call. In fact, we do have somebody standing by here ready to go, listening in Chicago. So let's go there for our first caller on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You talked about the three groups involved, the bully, the victim, and the group that encourages them. But from listening to accounts of bullying, and thinking in particular the account of the former Miss America who had that as her issue, it was pretty clear in her story that the teachers were involved as well. And I'm not sure if their involvement was simply not afraid of the bully's parent or afraid of the bully themselves, but they gave her absolutely no support and, in fact, almost encouraged it by their lack of action. I think one teacher told her, or the principal told her, that it was her personality that was causing the bullying. So in your research, how much do you come across this sort of complicit, I don't know whether to say they're involved in it, but the enabling behavior of the authorities in the school system?
It's a very good question. We actually start, and we haven't talked about this morning, but a number of the chapters address what we call school climate. And part of that is the teachers' attitudes. Adults, much like some people that are listening, are probably thinking, well, isn't this just part of growing up? You know, I dealt with it. I hit back. It ended, blah, blah, blah. So we can imagine what the attitudes are. Unfortunately, we have some teachers that still feel that way. So when they see it, in some cases, they might say, you're bringing it on yourself. There's very little research on that area. We're starting to look at it, but we do know that when teachers condone this behavior, those schools have the highest rates of bullying. When I tell people that if they want to do prevention programs in the schools, I need to have a conversation with their principal or their superintendent. If that principal or superintendent is not keen on doing any type of prevention, that program is not going to work in the school. So it's certainly, it is very important to have buy-in. The teachers have to be supportive. We found through the research we need 80% buy-in from teachers and administrators for a prevention program to work. We know that teachers condone this behavior. In some ways, they overlook it. So many of our prevention programs try to address that. We just had a young man in Anchorage, Alaska, who was chronically victimized, hung himself, and what was identified through litigation was that there were many teachers that said verbally and even admitted in a court case that they thought he was bringing it on himself. So unfortunately, it's true that teachers contribute to this. So we talk about school climate, not only the peers that are backing up, but there's some teachers that overlook it and don't intervene.
Okay, thank you.
Great question.
All right, well, thanks for the call. We have a couple of other people here. We'll take next line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Have you or any, do you have, are there people have researched this issue cross-culturally? What I'm thinking about is it been found that there's less bullying in societies that are more egalitarian or possibly countries where they don't allow the portrayal of violence in children's programming? You know, societies that seem to be less in love with heroic violence or violence in any kind than we are here in the United States?
It's a again, another great question. One, again, this phenomenon has been studied internationally more than it has in the United States. And I was just reading and reviewing an article actually looking at the problem, which they call IJMA or something, in Japan. And actually, this is, again, if you think about Japanese culture and the focus on the group as important, we've actually found internationally that the rates are very, very similar, that the phenomenon, again, about 15% of the kids are those that are bullies, and that seems to hold whether it's in the UK, other types of countries. So unfortunately, even in countries where there's not a huge focus on violence, access to guns, they're continuing to find these high rates. So even where there's this portrayal of the group as harmony and we'll include everyone, there's still this harassing behavior that kids engage in. So we can't attribute it just to our focus on violence and the fact that kids are viewing violence on TV and computer games. And the book talks about, you know, really that there's a lot of factors that contribute to it. It's not, you know, there's many children that are exposed to violence that are not nasty in the schools. Unfortunately, it's a cumulative type of thing where kids engage in these behaviors. So it doesn't seem to be, you know, unique to the United States. And again, I mean, much of our research, if you did any search on bullying, most of it's been done in Canada, Europe. There's a European coalition on bullying. We're not part of that, clearly. Canada is. We're not. We're completely behind in this area.
Yeah, well, of course, Japan, I think of as having a very, fairly violent society, even though they don't have guns like we do. I mean, you look at anime and their, you know, the kind of cartoons that they have. There's lots of portrayal of violence.
And in some ways in Japan, they're actually finding, related to the last caller, that a lot of the bullying actually stems from the adults putting a lot of pressure and kind of pinpointing individual differences in kids. So they're trying to educate the adults to, because they focus on, they're very competitive, and so they're trying to get the adults to not pinpoint kids that have deficits and not, and then they're targets for victimization. So it's a little bit more complicated within that culture, but yes, it's certainly, but it has been studied much more in some of these countries than in the United States.
So does Canada have pretty much the same rate as we do here?
Yes, they do. They're much more proactive. The Ministry of Education there has, much like the studies that have been conducted for the last 30 years in Norway, where the bully guru is, the Ministry of Education, you know, has really put this as kind of a priority for them. So they have countrywide prevention programs. We don't have that in this country. There's a big reluctance by the Department of Education here to focus on this topic. I mean, they're starting to change. But I mean, we have a bigger country. It's really hard to institute a nationwide prevention program. We just finally had the Department of Health Administration here come out with a bullying campaign, and it's taken years to do that. So
Have they found positive results in the countries where they have started to institute these kinds of policies?
Yeah, and we always refer to, again, the Norway studies where they've implemented, of course, it's a small country where they've implemented, but they've shown a reduction in 60 to 80% of bullying based on this Olivet's bullying prevention program that we're starting to implement in this country. Unfortunately, you know, with the state of the budget in this country, there's superintendents and school boards are having to make decisions about where to cut, and where they're cutting is where these kind of social programs for kids. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that weigh into this. But yes, certainly those things are working. Whether or not they translate to the United States schools is another question.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let me take a minute here and give you an opportunity to talk about the psychology of the bully, as far as we know. What is it that makes bullies be bullies?
Well, again, it's complicated. I think that we, for the longest time, we thought that these kids were just they came from dysfunctional families where violence was modeled, that they just didn't have social skills, and so they were aggressive in their peer group, and then they grew up to be bad boys, essentially, drawing upon the international research that really focused on boys. Now we know that girls are involved in these types of verbal harassment. We know that some of these kids are really good kids that have really heightened social skills. They know when to do this. They're not necessarily physically aggressive. They're not necessarily antisocial, involved in problems in the community. They can be the athletes. They can be some of the kids in our schools that the teachers like and admire and are some of the most popular kids. And for many people that are listening are like, this isn't surprising in some way. We remember when the jocks were those kind of hateful people that were mean, and we can see it in the movies and such. The research was not supporting that. We really saw them as kind of having these lacking of social skills. So in some ways, it's kind of a politician answer that we really don't understand the mind of the bully. And so we're starting to try to do research and understand that they're not socially rejected, that they actually are very skilled. They're liked by their peers to the extent that peers back them up. To the extent that they're running our hallways. I mean, I say that to some principals think they're running their school. Teachers think they're running their school. No, sometimes it's a seventh grade cohort in which there's a ringleader bully that's running their hallways. And so what do we know? Well, we certainly know that although they might be socially skilled, they also are coming from environments in which bullying or violence is modeled, and it works for them. So they might have a sibling that's bullying them at home. They might have a parent that engages in some type of aggression that works for them. And then they engage in those behaviors in schools, and it works for them. They become more popular. They get more dates if they're boys. And so we really are just beginning to understand the psyche of the bully and trying to reject some of the research that we've done for 30 years. So we're...
Well, that's really interesting because it's so counterintuitive. You think that the bully is somebody who is hated and feared, and in fact, what it looks like is that bullying might be a way to acquire and maintain social dominance, and that could be viewed as a positive thing. That is, that person could be viewed popular. Instead of being hated and feared, this could be the person everybody wants to be. Everybody wants to be with them. You want to be in their group. And that rather than, wanting to run and hide, you'd say, well, I want to do everything I can to be in with this person.
Right. So you back him up or her up. And you don't know this, but you're citing Anthony Pellegrini's work, Dominance Theory, Bukowski's Attraction Theory. The bottom line is if you're a bully and you engage in these behaviors, you will get more dates. Empirical research shows this. Girls want to go out with the bad boy. There's people listening think, yes, there's actually research to back this up. And it's certainly true. So you're really, in some ways, when we talk about dominance, this is exactly what we're showing. It works for kids in middle school. And it's starting to work as early as fourth grade. This is starting to work. And so dominance theory and attraction theory and other theories really support that there are many, many benefits to being a bully in middle school beyond getting in trouble. You're not getting in trouble. You're getting dates. You're seen as the person that everyone wants to be friends with. And it's complicated in some ways because I could say to David, David is the bully and I want to be your friend. And, I don't necessarily agree with everything you do, but I want to be part of your group. So then I engage in behaviors that I know better. You know, we're in many Catholic schools in the state of Illinois where they have religion class every day. But what they end up doing outside of religion class totally goes against the teaching. So it's not just kind of teaching kids how to be respectful. They know how to be respectful. But the bottom line is changing the climate so that there's rewards built into being respectful versus disrespectful. Because at this point, there's too many benefits for bullies. Why would they change their behavior?
We are already getting close to the midpoint of the program here, and our guest is Dorothy Esplosh. She's professor of educational psychology at the University of Illinois. We're talking about bullying, and questions are welcome. We have several people who are standing by. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the next caller is in Champaign. That'll be line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, I was listening to this. It's quite intriguing. I came from a small town environment where there was a social hierarchy in the town, starting with the parents, with wealth and different things, and you know, it comes down to the children, and the school system was quite horrific with what people had to get through. And I honestly believe it starts with the parents on every level of this subject, that the parents do it to other people, how they view them, how they talk about other people, how the children's home life is with the parents really is what I believe creates the victim and the bully and the people that support the bully.
It's a good comment. I'll interrupt you there. And unfortunately, again, that's another area where we have not done enough research. But I agree with you. And I think that there's a number of, you know, we've looked at mostly physically aggressive kids, and certainly family has been implicated there. Many of my teachers feel like it starts at home. That's true. And we're talking about how it might be kind of starting at home, and now we're talking about how the school just kind of fosters this. And certainly we know that that's true. Unfortunately, there's not a lot that we can do in the schools is trying to change kind of parental attitudes. We're trying to do that. It's a very expensive program. And again, in the light of the budget cuts, it's hard to think about that. You know, when you talk about small towns, and we do a lot of research in the state of Illinois, so there's lots of small towns. So I was just kind of smiling when you made a comment that unfortunately people think that these really small communities, that the bullying would be less, right? Because you grow up with these kids many, many years. Unfortunately, there is a hierarchy in these in the towns. The parents know who are the haves and the have-nots. The administration, even in these small schools, you know, are part of that system. And those are the most difficult schools to go in and do work and change that climate. We struggle with many schools in this state and other Midwestern states, and it's probably not unique to Illinois. But you're right. Unfortunately, I think if we take just the approach that it's all at home and not focus on some school-based programs, we're not understanding that that kids spend more time with teachers and in schools than they do with their parents. So I think that we certainly need to incorporate the family as much as possible, but also try to counter that as much as possible so that kids go home and question what their parents are saying. Some prevention programs, parents get very upset with us sometimes because kids will come home and say and question their parents, like, why did you say that about such and such? Why are you making that comment based on how much money they have or where they live? And parents get upset about us teaching them values because kids start to then question the ideology of their parents. And unfortunately, that's what I think we're going to have to do in the schools. It's uncomfortable for parents. We don't like to change as adults. We like to have our little groups, but kids learn from that. And I think, yeah, you're right. In many, many ways, parents are modeling this exclusionary behavior.
I found that when I was going to school, especially junior high and high school, that there were some kids. I was not the most popular, but I wasn't the least popular in school, just, you know, if you want to put it that way. But to deal with the people that wanted to try to cut me down, something my father gave me, that I'm going to give my kids. You have to stand your ground, and physical only really begets more physical. The best way to do it is outsmart them.
And unfortunately, there's a number of prevention programs that talk about that. Use humor, you know, outsmart them, come back with a wittier. And I think and probably that's your personality. Some victims just don't have that personality. So I think that, you know, what works for you, what works for other, you know, victims are not going to be the same thing. So we try to kind of have you know, as much as possible, change that climate. We're not into blaming the victim. Many of us, you know, think about, yeah, like, how can you outsmart? Use humor. Don't let them get to you. Unfortunately, I think unless we change society, the climate, teachers' attitudes, parents' attitudes, and we continue to just say, you know, the victim needs to take this on themselves as a fourth grader, as a middle schooler who's trying to figure out who they are. This is not working. I'm glad it worked for you, but many of my victims into adulthood have severe self-esteem issues based on how it is that they were interacting with somebody in fifth grade. That's damaging. I'm glad that you've kind of, you know, had that strength to move on. But many of the victims are just, they shut down. They go into, you know, la-la land. And so our prevention programs, we're trying to, you know, take that responsibility away from a fifth grader who's like trying to study and learn and, you know, grow up to be a functional adult, and to say that the adults around need to be more responsible. Yeah. Again, going back to your comment about the family in general.
Yeah. It's a phenomenon that is sickening to me, I think that this is good and we need more of it.
Great.
We need to focus on this and we need to stamp it out because it is a serious problem that destroys people's lives.
I agree.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call. Let's go on here. We have someone else also in Champaign, and this would be line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You've answered, I guess, some of the questions I wanted to ask. How do these bullies behave as adults? Do they carry over their bullying habit?
It's actually a very good question. I was just commissioned by the Centers for Disease Control to answer that very question in the next few months. What we've taken from, again, the Norwegian research is that they've shown that these bullies are 60% of them go on to have a felony by the age of 21. So we have some of that data, again, that just says Norwegian data. The reason that that we're focusing on it is that there is some sense that some of these bullies go on to have a criminal career. Unfortunately, I think many of these bullies go on to probably be very functional. Okay, now we don't have data on this, but I think that if we looked at this, these are, as we're beginning to kind of reshape our thinking about a bully and the skills that they have, they can end up being CEOs, they can end up being lawyers, they can end up being policemen, and I'm not necessarily picking on any careers, mm-hmm. but I'm just highlighting some of those skills. They have very strong leadership skills. They're able to somehow get, you know, groups of kids to rally around them. So think about those, you know, skills, much like a politician. So I don't think we have a definitive answer to that question. What the CDC is concerned about is those kids that are bullies that see aggression, whether it's verbal, other forms of aggression, as functional, it works for them. Then do they take that into dating relationships? Do they become sexual assaulters? Do they become, you know, aggressive against their spouses and partners? That's a very question. It's an interesting question. Unfortunately, what's happened, and again, this is kind of an academic thing that's happened, but many of our sexual assault, even in the state of Illinois, sexual assault coalitions have now focused their energy on teaching kids not to bully in middle school, hoping they will not end up being assault perpetrators. So what we're concerned about is that we're taking all of our kind of prevention dollars, dumping it into focusing on the bullying, hoping that this cuts down on domestic violence, when in fact we don't have that empirical link. So it's a very good question. We don't necessarily know. Is there a group of them that kind of just grow out of this and then kind of channel that those leadership skills into more functional things like being a professor and being on the radio and convincing you all to care about bullying? I don't know.
Yes,
it's a good question.
I was thinking back over some of the bullies I've known over quite a few years now, they do seem to fall into two groups. Particularly a couple I knew when I was in the Army were, I think, intrinsically antisocial and had trouble with the law even before they got into the Army. On the other hand, I've known some who had very high social skills.
Right, and exactly. That's exactly what we're finding, is that there's different types of bullies, and so they have different kind of personality profiles. It's in some ways, if you think about the military and hazing and fraternities, a lot of what we're talking about are those same types of behaviors that go on in middle school and high school. So, yeah.
They all seem to attract a following. That's the one common thread I see in them.
And if they didn't have the following, I mean, we could just look at basic behavioral theory.
Yeah.
They are engaging in these behaviors because it works for them. They're being reinforced. So as soon as that little audience does not pay attention, they're going to change their behavior. As soon as the teachers, you know, stop this, as soon as the administrators don't tolerate it, as soon as it's not seen as cool, then it, you're exactly right that they attract a following. And this is why it continues to this day.
I probably shouldn't say this, but there's a certain politician at the head of the country at present who often acts like a schoolyard bully. And I'm wondering, does intervention have any remedial effect upon these people?
We're actually showing through the prevention programs that the immediate effect, it takes a while, unless you're impacting the climate. Again, it's much, you know, I've done a lot of alcohol and drug work, and, you know, you can take the alcohol away from someone, but you got to give them something back. So if these kids are being reinforced for being bullies, what are we going to give them? So we try to get these bullies to channel their leadership thing, you know, skills into other ways. And so we're having some success in this country. But again, I want to just reiterate, we are very, very behind in this area. We cannot start doing prevention programs until we understand what it is that's contributing to this, getting adults to understand that we contribute, that our attitudes, our biases are being, you know, translated into how it is that kids interact.
Well, thank you. I think I'm going to have to find a copy of your book.
Great.
Right. Well, thanks for the call. And our guest this morning, maybe I should introduce again. Our guest is Dorothy Espalache. She's professor of educational psychology at the University of Illinois. And indeed, she's the co-editor of a book that's titled Bullying in American Schools. So if you're interested in reading up more on the subject, looking at some of the research that has been done, you can take a look at that book. And of course, here on the show, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that there was a time, and maybe even still, where if we went out and we just asked people, okay, describe, when we say bully to you, what do you think of? And that people, the first thing that they will say was, this is a boy. That it's a male, bullying is a male thing. And but of course, now in the past, you know, relatively recent time, I think we're starting to get more and more research and also writing in popular media about girl bullying and the fact that it exists. It may tend to be much more involving things like verbal harassment and emotional harassment and excluding people from the group and stuff like that. Then, you know, maybe boy bullying might be a little bit more physical, even though it involves some of that same kind of stuff. But girls do it too. Is that something that's new, or do we have reason to believe that maybe that's always gone on too? And yet, we weren't looking for it, we didn't pay attention to it, or we were too much into the idea that bullying was something physical, and if that wasn't going on, then we weren't noticing.
Right. I think for the longest time, we were looking at administrators, teachers, they discipline physical aggression. And so for the longest time, much of what we call relational aggression, that's what you're calling when we talk about girl aggression, boys do this too, relational aggression. I will be your friend only if you go along with what I say. I will be your friend if you're not friends with her and such and whatever. What we're actually showing, this is a very huge disconnect, however, by what's seen in the popular press, what's seen in the popular media versus the research. So if you read some of the books that are out there in Barnes & Noble, other places, you'll see that girls, they actually describe girls as not physically aggressive. And there's some people listening that are in schools that have broken up girl fights and will say, well, that's just not true. And so there's a disconnect between what's being said about girl aggression in the popular literature and what's being said in the research. In fact, boys are just as relationally aggressive. They engage in rumor spreading. They engage in exclusion in different types of ways than girls. And so we're, unfortunately, it's nice that people are writing the popular press about the girls and the horror stories that girls have and they're catty. Unfortunately, it's sending a message that girls are not physically aggressive and that boys are physically aggressive. And in fact, we find that they engage in all of these behaviors. And in some schools, girls are more physically aggressive than the boys. And so you're right that I think that we've always focused on physical aggression. It's only from the school shootings that we focused on, oh my gosh, these kids are hateful in ways that we're just not noticing through disciplinary action and other types of things. So certainly it's an academic argument about girl aggression and boy aggression. What is that? And I think one of the chapters is called, like, let's move beyond talking about differences. Let's just really try to understand how it is that kids use aggression and how it's effective within our schools.
Okay. We have a number of other callers. These folks are all in Urbana, so we'll take them in the order, 1, 2, 3, starting with line 1. Hello.
Couple of points. One is that I was glad to hear you talking about counselors who work on domestic violence and rape associating this with the bullying. I was thinking that when you talked about people saying you asked for it and telling kids you asked for it, it's very much like where we were and to some extent still are with rape victims saying you asked for it. And a lot of women still feel that way, and a lot of guys feel that women ask for it if they dress in a particular way or act in a particular way. The other thing is there's a commercial that's running on TV at the moment. I think I saw it when I was watching the Olympics. It's a line of young women who are walking along with their cell phones, and they're advertising. I think it's Singular. Mm-hmm. And they're all set for school. And they say it's not that they're mean, and they look at each other cross-eyed. I mean, not cross-eyed. They cut their glance at each other. It's just, and then they say, but we're just good shoppers. And that's why they have this particular plan so they can talk to each other. And I was thinking, you know, it looks like they're almost saying, like, yeah, we really are mean. I'm wondering how much cell phones and the access to them and the use of them increases rumor spreading and increases the ability to exclude people who don't have cell phones at school.
It's not only cell phones. It's instant messaging, and this is something that we've just started to study. There was a piece in New York Times yesterday that people were talking about yesterday and this morning, and this isn't new to us. In the last few years, we started to talk to kids about and just had an open question on some of our research about when they were bullied, and they started to talk about instant messaging. And so I've started to talk about how it is that instant messaging, cell phones, text messaging is being used. It is really kind of sad to think how it's being used, because the fortunate thing about rumor spreading when we went to school is by the time it got to the 20th person, the rumor was so ridiculous, right? So we banked on that. There's no way I possibly did that. Now when they're using instant messaging, that rumor is intact. That rumor with one click of a mouse or one send on a cell phone, one little button, could go to hundreds of people. It could go to listservs that they set up in schools. And so everyone can see this rumor. It's not only in text, but it could be pictures. It could be other things that you might have engaged in that's now kind of permanent in a, you know, a program. So unfortunately, I don't have a cell phone, which is amazing. I'm sure people are listening, Dorothy, don't have a cell phone, but I refuse to, because I think that in many ways it's contributing to a lot of problems. And bullying is just one of them. Rude behavior on top of that, and just how it is that we're becoming very isolated and tied to a cell phone, and how it is that kids are harassing each other. So, yeah, I think and there's very, very little research. Again, another area, I was just at a conference, there were European people, researchers there. They're so on top of how it is that kids are harassing each other. And how it is that adults are preying on children. What we forget is that, they said this in the New York Times piece too, that it's not just adults that are preying on children. It's these peers that are just harassing each other, and it goes beyond the school hours, right? So this can go on forever and ever. And so, yes, cell phones and computers are introducing a whole new dimension, and it's very, very scary when you start to think about it.
I guess you can add these cell phone cameras too. As you were talking, I was just thinking, think of the cameras and where you can take pictures, compromising pictures of somebody in the locker room.
Yeah, we're way beyond the note that you could used to be able to shred, you know, or the little blurb on the bathroom wall that we could just paint over. I mean, we just can't kind of paint the rumor that's on the bathroom wall anymore. I mean, it's a text. It's something that can be saved and can be distributed to hundreds and thousands of kids.
I was growing up, it's been some time, and junior high school was particularly awful, as I recall. You couldn't expect to predict who was going to do the harassing based on their degree of religiosity. And oftentimes it seemed like the kids who went to church the most and talked about it the most were often the harassers in my own little experience. And I was,
church attendance, we get these questions all the time. We ask that. Church attendance does not predict at all. You could be the, you know, go to church, be in church groups, youth groups, and you could still be a bully. So that does not protect, unfortunately.
Yeah. Thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. We'll go on to another caller here. This is also Urbana, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I was wanting to know what your research or research in general shows as far as the relationship between, say, sexual orientation and gender identity with bullying.
Very interesting question. An area that we are trying to study more in the state of Illinois, many, many principals and superintendents don't like us to ask questions about sexual orientation. So it's interesting. I was talking to a student last night. He was like, I hope I can find a school where I can ask these questions or say words like gay and fag, which kids say all the time. But so if there's any superintendents that want us to study this in the school. The few studies that we've been able to do in this country where the administration has been open to this, bullying, there is a lot of homophobia and bantering among males and females where you know, you might not be questioning your sexual orientation, but the group will be calling you certain types of names and you begin to question. This is an area that the federal government is concerned about. The suicide rate is very high among middle school and high school students that are questioning their sexual orientation or have come to terms with their sexual orientation and therefore are harassed through this. This is an area that we need to start studying, one, because it's a public health issue for kids. Again, there's a huge reluctance to even say the two words that I said on the radio that people are probably like, ooh, putting their fingers in their ears. But yes, we certainly know that there's a lot of harassment that's centered around this, but we need to do more research.
I find the topic very interesting because for myself, when I was going through grade school, I was the bully. I was a big bully. And then I get to high school, and I was just the opposite. I was the one that was bullied. I've known since third grade that I was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And now beyond high school and beyond college, I find myself to be a very strong advocate and activist for equality for everyone,
right.
All people. So I kind of cringe also when I hear about programs that are being initiated in schools and think to myself, if those programs were initiated when I was in school, I would not today be seeing myself working towards my second master's degree. I would probably be washing dishes somewhere. Because of the alternative schools that we decide to put students into because they aren't acting properly in the regular mainstream school.
Right.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
We spent a lot of time this morning talking about the dimensions of the problem, and we're now getting into about our last 10 minutes, and I at least want to give you a chance to talk for a couple of minutes about the prevention aspect, and particularly, I guess, you know, the difficult issue of the enabling bystanders. Seems that you can deal with the aggressor, that's one thing, but as you said, what you say to administrators and teachers and everybody. So you have to look at the whole atmosphere because you by just taking the bully out, taking them down to the principal's office and giving them a lecture and saying, don't do that, you know, do whatever you're going to do with them, that's really not going to change anything unless you look at the entire atmosphere.
Right. And so, you know, I'm asked by a lot of school districts to focus on helping them with programs. And one, this is a very, very difficult task, and it takes years of commitment. So if there are teachers or administrators listening or parents that want to kind of take on this task within their school because they have a child that's being bullied or they're concerned about this issue, they need to know that they have to really commit to a good 5-year plan. People don't like to hear that because we're Americans and we like Band-Aid approaches and we want a quick fix. And unfortunately, you need 1 year of good planning. I've already quoted that we need 80% buy-in. So you need 80% of your teachers. You need 100% administrators because they're the ones that run the show. 80% of your teachers. You need parents on board to change that climate. And also to get the buy-in from the kids. We forget that, you know, and I'm here at the university and we go and we talk to kids, but kids sabotage prevention programs on a daily basis in our schools. We talk to kids all the time about all the programs they have to attend. And they can very quickly in a day's time take your you know, $500,000 program and completely sabotage it. So you have to get their buy-in as well. And so it takes a long time to get this commitment. We've talked about the component of the family. So how is it that we can get parents on board when, in fact, they think that this is overblown, bullying's talked about too much, they're concerned about even being scrutinized within their own kind of home. So how do we get all of these involved? Unfortunately, In the state of Illinois, I work with a number of really poor school districts, right? So at any point, teachers could have a pink slip in their box, okay? So how do we work with those school districts that don't have the money for the Olvitz bullying prevention program that cost thousands and thousands of dollars? I work with those school districts. We have someone that's committed to take this lead. We work very closely, and we can do it through prevention programs. Some prevention programs are $39.95, and if we get the community involved, we get the parents involved, we get the buy-in from the students, then we start talking about how it is that we can reward respectful behavior and how it is that we can get kids to understand the very, very hurtful ways that they're interacting with each other. I mean, many kids are engaging in these behaviors. They think it's just part of growing up because we've said that. That's just kind of how we act. We think about the commercial, they're just mean, but it doesn't really hurt my feelings. Mm. How can we get kids to really understand that this does hurt your feelings? How would this feel if it was directed towards you? And so we work a lot, very closely with kids. We work with teachers. We work with parents. Again, you know, as I talk about this in the few minutes that we have, it takes a commitment from a community. It's not just pulling out kids that are bullies. It's not just pulling out chronic victims and homeschooling them. It's changing the entire way in which we think about aggression in our schools.
We have a couple other callers. We'll try to get at least one more. Urbana, line 3.
Hello.
Yes.
Up until the time I called, which was about 20 minutes ago, you hadn't talked about girls bullying. And I just wanted to tell you about experience my daughter had. That this was in the 70s in middle school. And she was relentlessly bullied by 3 black girls. They shoved her up against the wall. They punched her. They did all kinds of things. The only trouble is I didn't find out about this until it was too late, until sometime later. So I just wanted to make sure that you knew that girls were doing the same thing.
Most certainly, and they're not just using words. There are many very physically aggressive girls out there. So I caution people that are reading some of these texts or watching Oprah or whatever you're watching, to let's not forget that girls are aggressive. Girls are, you know, ending up in probation. They're not just using words. Thank you.
They punched my daughter and they slammed her up against the wall. So I wanted you to know that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Yes, I was calling. I really appreciate this subject. I have 4 sons and have dealt with this over the years. But I now have 2 of my sons at the university level, and it's been interesting how they've both observed that once they graduated from high school, it was just over. None of this went on at the university level. And maybe it does in fraternities or sororities, but not in the general classroom. And I just wondered what your observation is on that after they leave public schools.
Yeah, it actually is interesting. Nikki Crick, who's the kind of scholar that introduced the term relational aggression, is actually she's looking at some university samples in this country, and she's showing relational aggression, this cattiness, is actually translating to some university samples. Unfortunately, I'd like to say that it just ends. And, you know, I teach undergraduate, so I know here even at the university it doesn't just end, and it's not isolated just to fraternities and sororities. I think what's nice about the university and this big university is that kids can find their niche, they can find their group where they don't necessarily, they're not stuck in a high school, right? And they can go and find, you know, a safe place.
Right.
But I think it's still, what our concern is if in fact you're a bully in middle and high school, to what extent does this translate into your interpersonal relationships? And I think it varies. Now, there's some studies that actually show in some smaller universities, there's a huge university here, but some smaller universities, it's very much like high school.
That's what I wondered, if
yes.
It had to do with the size. And
the size makes a big difference, because
yeah.
If you harass me here at the University of Illinois, I could just go find somebody else. I can stay away from you.
Right.
Very small. And there's a lot of small schools in the Midwest. And in fact, it's very difficult to get away from. There might be actually, again, groups of kids, cohorts even at the university level, where these behaviors continue. We've looked at some sororities and fraternities here at this university and other universities across the country, and we're seeing some of the same types of behaviors, whether you call it hazing or not, some same types of rumor spreading, exclusionary types of behaviors. It's actually a good point.
Right. Okay. Well, good. Thank you for commenting on that.
All right. Thank you. And real quick here, we'll try to go Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Hi. When you talk about people being bullies or being bullied, I wonder if the categories are really that rigid. Because when I think back to my school experience, it seemed like they were kind of fluid. Like people could go back and forth between being bullies or being bullied, and it would sort of depend on what year it was or what social group they were in. And it was still a definite problem, but I don't think it was necessarily that clear that there was this type of person that was a bully and this type of person that was bullied or was a bystander.
Yeah, actually, it's a good point. And many victims, it's very, very stable. For chronic victims, it's stable. But certainly we have, and we didn't talk about that today, it's a whole another area of research, what we call the bully victim, where you can actually be bullied, and then you bully yourself because you see that it works. And so there's certainly some instability kind of factor there. It's a very, very good point. We argue about it in the literature. You certainly could read the book, and you'll see a lot of where the nomenclature continually changes. Good point.
And I appreciate the comments of the callers and everyone who called in. We'll have to leave it there because we're at the end of the time. But as we have mentioned, if you're interested in reading some of the research on bullying, you can look for the book co-edited by our guest, Dorothy Espelage. The book is titled Bullying in American Schools. It is available in paperback, and it's published by Lawrence Erlbaum Associates, co-edited with Susan Swearer from University of Nebraska. Dorothy Espelage, she's professor of educational psychology here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Us.